Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Advisors to Governor-elect Ron DeSantis talk school safety.
Many of these failures were the result of the culture surrounding school safety.
Also this week, Florida Governor-elect Ron DeSantis is setting himself apart from the outgoing administration.
There's the campaign and then there's governing, and one would hope that there would be a real distinction.
We'll also learn how human rights and business groups are joining forces to battle Florida's high incidence of human trafficking, and we'll discover what's being done to improve the lot of the state's female prison inmates. I'm Tom Flanagan. Happy New Year, and welcome to Capitol Report. Advisors to Governor-elect Ron DeSantis want greater action on school safety. Sean Mulcahy reports this comes after the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Commission released the first draft of its report.
Members of the Governor-elect's Public Safety Transition Team are teeing up for a fight between the state and local school boards. Although the legislature passed sweeping school safety reforms after last year's Parkland shooting, they've been slow to take effect. A big sticking point for many superintendents is the Guardian program. It allows for armed guards on campuses, but many districts have refused to participate. Florida Office of Safe Schools Director Damian Miller, however, wants to continue to grow the program.
I see the Guardian program as the only option for certain school districts in certain counties, and I'm very happy that we have that program available.
Andy Pollock, whose daughter was killed in the Parkland shooting, agrees.
Bureaucrats don't understand police work. We need to take the bureaucrats out of the mix of policing in schools and give it to the police departments and the sheriff's department.
The MSD Commission wants to expand the Guardian program and arm teachers. But Patrick Miller, president of the private security firm Invictus, is pushing a private sector contract option.
With the drawdown in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other areas of the world, we have well-trained security assets who can supplement law enforcement as a force multiplier and as a cost-effective option here in the state of Florida.
Lawmakers discussed arming teachers last session, but faced blowback from education advocates and teachers' unions. Another issue eyed by Public Safety Transition Chairman Kent Sturman is mandatory safety reporting. Schools have missed deadlines or not reported at all. And some, like Clay County Sheriff Daryl Daniels, argue schools are doing this intentionally.
When we determine whether there's compliance or non-compliance, we need to make a determination whether or not it's done ignorantly or purposely, speaking specifically to non-compliance. And we have nothing in place to hold people accountable who make a conscious decision not to comply with the law. This is the law.
Daniels recommends bringing criminal charges against administrators who don't comply. Jeff Bell of the Broward Sheriff's Office Deputies Association suggests a more mellowed approach, docking funding or tying reporting into school grades.
You can attach a rating or add in an additional component to the school rating that are highly regarded by our schools to attract charters and magnet programs into their schools, and whether or not they're compliant to these new standards that are being put into effect here in Florida.
Advisors also want to change the way law enforcement, mental health professionals, and school staff interact. Polk County Sheriff Grady Judd is calling for a cultural change in addressing school safety.
The legislature has got to make it a priority. The governor has got to make it a priority. We have got to mandate and force some of these culture changes, as has been spoken about, because they absolutely, unequivocally aren't going to change on their own. And that's not exclusively school systems. That's also law enforcement response, mental health response as well.
The idea of a culture change is echoed by Florida Department of Law Enforcement Commissioner Rick Swearingen. In the case of the Parkland shooting, he notes failures of the education system, police, and mental health providers. And he says,
one of the most important things to note is that many of these failures were the result of the culture surrounding school safety. There must be a change in this culture if we are to prevent future incidents.
Going hand in hand with changing the way officials view school safety is changing the way law enforcement interacts with schools. At the crux of it, says Chairman Sturman, is finding people equipped to address school safety.
Alarming to me how difficult it is to find the people who are qualified and willing to do this work.
That's in part because many education advocates have fought back against parts of the 2018 school safety measures, and the issue will likely play a key role in this year's legislative session as well. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sean Mulcahy.
Governor-elect Ron DeSantis officially takes office this coming Tuesday. DeSantis stuck with Fox News as his media outlet of choice during the campaign, and he largely stayed quiet during the election recount. Since then, his transition teams have been crafting policy plans. He's announced new state agency chiefs that political observers call qualified candidates. He's even crossed the aisle to hire Democrats to lead Florida's Department of Emergency Management and Department of Revenue. And unlike his predecessor, Rick Scott, DeSantis says environmental issues will be among his priorities. Florida Public Radio's Gina Jordan talks with Carol Weissert, professor of political science at Florida State University, about the change in DeSantis since the campaign.
DeSantis has started hiring staff and he's made some political appointments. Do you see a trend emerging in those choices?
Yeah, I think the trend is he's picking experienced hands in Tallahassee who know how to operate here and who have a lot of background. And I think that's good. He does not have a lot of background in Tallahassee, very little. And I think he recognizes that and he's picking people who do, and one assumes he's going to listen to him.
What kind of reception do you see DeSantis getting overall with his appointments so far?
Well, I think it's good. I think people, he's picked some Democrats. He's picked some people who, as he said, who have a lot of experience. I know there were some people that didn't particularly like the choice for Commissioner of Education.
Richard Corcoran.
But Corcoran has a lot of experience in education as well. So that may be a more of an ideological choice. And that sort of fits in with some of the campaign issues. But I think a lot of governors do that. You know, there's the campaign and then there's governing. And one would hope that they would be a real distinction, and I think it looks like that's going to be a distinction with DeSantis.
And so we know that he has chosen a couple of Democrats for key positions, so he's shown a willingness to cross the aisle to put the people that he thinks are appropriate into place. When have we seen that?
You know, not as often as you would like, I think. I think what really makes it striking today is that with this polarization that we see in Washington and on the campaign trail, to see somebody do it makes us feel pretty good about the process.
What do you think DeSantis's choices so far tell us about the way he will lead?
My guess would be that he's willing to listen, that he's not coming in with a big agenda on his own, that he's bringing people on who will give him good advice and then he will make decisions on that advice. I don't see a lot of evidence, with maybe the exception of education, that he's coming in really with a strong ideological bent that he's going to drain the swamp in Tallahassee. I think he's really coming in looking to be a responsible governor.
How do you think his actions or decisions so far differ from the way he ran his campaign for governor?
Well, he didn't talk much about issues, actually. So there was a real concern, I think, on a lot of people about what he was going to do when he was governor, because it was a campaign very much tied to Trump. And there wasn't very much on Florida at all. And I think that was a disappointment to a lot of people, because the governor really isn't an accolade of the president, but it is somebody who is the key person to make policy and implement policy in Florida. So I'm really happy that there seems to be a real distinction in his mind between what he did on the campaign and what he's doing now.
Do you think there are any particular similarities possibly in the way DeSantis will govern compared to Rick Scott? Do you have any inkling of that so far?
It's hard to know. My sense at this point is that he's a better listener. I think Scott did come in with a lot of ideas, although he didn't have much experience in Tallahassee as well.
So as far as being a better listener, Scott came in with ideas that he implemented. quickly. Period. Yeah, quickly. And DeSantis, you think, is going to really listen?
It's hard to know. He could come in and come down with a whole list. But my sense is so far that he's making decisions very carefully. He's rolling out these positions slowly. It looks like he's taking his time. He's talking to people. So I think, so far he's doing what's exactly right. I guess the only other thing is I'm looking for a little more diversity. I haven't seen a lot of diversity. In an ideal world, I would put some more women in some of these top positions and certainly a little more diversity in race and ethnicity.
Carol Weisert, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida lawmakers are poised once again to debate the issue of firearms on the state's college and university campuses.
The point of the bill is simply public safety.
Florida human rights and business groups join forces to fight the scourge of human trafficking.
They were housed many to a room, anywhere between 15 to 20 to a condominium, and they were being paid like $1 an hour.
A bill already filed aims at giving incarcerated women in Florida's correctional facilities the dignity they deserve. Representative Chevron Jones is the sponsor. He says he's heard some degrading stories from former inmates.
Even if a woman is in a is incarcerated, she should not feel any less than a woman.
And we'll look back on the political career of the only Florida U.S. senator to have gone into space. In the coming session, Florida's legislature will consider a bill aiming to eliminate gun-free zones on college campuses. Ryan Daly reports for state lawmakers the issue has come up before.
So this is a repeal bill, so it's been filed a few times in the last few years in Florida.
That's Republican State Representative Anthony Sabatini talking about the bill he filed this week.
The point of the bill is simply public safety. You know, we just got done taking a good look at the nine-month Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Public Safety Commission, and its findings were that my takeaway that gun-free zones are not a good thing and that armed teachers increase public safety. So this is really sort of a similar issue. It's a corollary issue, in my opinion.
Sabatini uses the February high school shooting that claimed 17 lives to frame his argument against gun-free zones.
As we saw with Parkland, any mass shooting, gun-free zones are inherently dangerous because they're purposely targeted by mass shooters. They will always go to a place in which they essentially either can't be stopped or it takes an extremely long period of time for law enforcement to respond.
Similar measures have been filed before in recent years. And Sabatini, a freshman state lawmaker from Lake County, says the argument for gun-free zones is misguided.
Their argument is if anyone has a gun anywhere, that place is somehow less safe. I think they have an irrational fear of guns. I'm a National Guardsman, been in the National Guard for 10 years, been a permit holder for a few years, and carried my weapon quite a bit. And if anything, it makes me feel more safe. I just don't see the point of removing guns simply because somebody has an irrational fear of concealed weapon permit holders.
We strongly oppose allowing loaded concealed weapons or openly carrying weapons on college campuses.
Andy Pelosi is director of the Campaign to Keep Guns Off Campus.
We think that it only creates an unsafe environment, increased risk for everyone, students, faculty, staff, and visitors.
Pelosi is no stranger to the debate, which he says he has observed and participated in over the years.
I think this is at least the fifth session in a row. It could be more than that, where guns on campus has come up in Florida. I know that in 2011 it was also defeated, but there may have been a break in between. But at any rate, we've seen this type of legislation introduced in both houses, for several years now.
And Pelosi says it wasn't just Democrats who axed the bill in years past.
So it's been defeated, and it's interesting that in the Senate, it's been defeated by Republicans, in a bipartisan manner.
In Pelosi's view, guns on campus is not something Florida's colleges are actively seeking out.
The Association of Florida Colleges, as well as President Thrasher at FSU and other college presidents around the state, are all opposed to allowing concealed weapons on campus, and for good reason. The crime rate on Florida colleges is very low compared to what's happening off campus. I mean, that's documented, you know, something we've talked about for several years now. Law enforcement, on-campus law enforcement is not something that they support. Faculty are strongly opposed to this also. It's really something that the schools are not asking for.
And indeed, Florida State University President John Thrasher has been vocal against having guns on campus. Most recently, an off-campus shooting in October took multiple lives of people affiliated with the school. The tragedy prompted the former Republican state lawmaker to say this at a vigil held for those who died.
I have fought for 4 years and the previous 2 years when I was in the Florida legislature to keep guns off this campus. And I promise you, I will continue to fight that fight.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
Human trafficking. To most of us, that crime might seem remote, even exotic, possibly conjuring up images of shadowy international crime syndicates with unseen pipelines of hapless third world victims. Then you talk with Robin Hassler Thompson. She's the executive director of Florida's Survive and Thrive Advocacy Center. And she says human trafficking is a lot closer to home than most of us realize.
Florida still is number 3 in the nation when it comes to the cases of human trafficking that are reported to our hotline. There are so many places in Florida that are right here in our area that are attracting trafficking.
Another factor that makes detecting and fighting human trafficking difficult, says Vanya Yovera, assistant director of the Center for the Advancement of Human Rights at Florida State University, is that so many can fall victim to the crime.
We have U.S. citizens, we have foreign nationals, we have men, women, children. Really, the only commonality that we see is that there is some vulnerability that can be exploited if someone is homeless, for example. Anyone that is looking for a better life and is promised a job somewhere.
But the promised job turns out to be a ruse to essentially hold the victim in virtual slavery. Sometimes the state's giant tourism industry becomes an inadvertent accomplice when it deals with contractors who turn out to be human traffickers. Yovera cites a recent case when traffickers suddenly showed up in Northwest Florida with dozens of young women.
Bringing them to the Sandestin area, working at the Sandestin Hilton and many other resorts area in the Panhandle. They were working very long hours. They were housed many to a room, anywhere between 15 to 20 to a condominium, and they were being paid like $1 an hour.
No reputable hotel wants to be connected with human trafficking, so Jeff Lubkeman, senior vice president with the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, says his organization has set up a special online resource to give hotels and motel personnel more awareness of the problem.
FRLA, human trafficking. The first search return will be a link that gets the participant there. It's about a 30 to 35 minute self-directed online course that we're making available absolutely free of charge. But it's targeted and specifically designed for hourly employees and managers in both food operations and lodging operations to raise awareness.
Susan Turner, co-owner of Tallahassee eatery Food Glorious Food, thinks that'll be a handy tool for restaurants like hers. Even though she's never been offered workers by human traffickers, she's personally aware of some who were.
There were other restaurants, and there was a huge group of Eastern European girls who were waitresses, and there was definitely evidence there of being human trafficked.
Human traffickers not only target places that serve prepared food, they have also traditionally targeted food growers. To fight back, FSU's Vanya Yovera says the Coalition of Immokalee Workers has an initiative to battle human trafficking in the growing fields.
Well, what the Fair Food Program really guarantees is that the farms that are part of this program are looking out for their employees. This program basically started with the tomato industry. Florida produces about 80% of tomatoes for the entire country.
The program has since expanded and now has some of the state's largest food retailers using it to ensure the food they sell is not being cultivated by what is in essence slave labor. Ultimately, says the Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association's Lubkeman, every consumer and business has to stay aware and vigilant to make sure they're not contributing to the problem.
Every business has the opportunity to ask a lot of questions, make sure they know their suppliers, make sure they know where the labor's coming from, the food's coming from, and all of their supplies. And the more questions we ask, if one business at a time forecloses the opportunity for either slave-produced food or trafficked labor, if they do that one business at a time, then we will make a difference.
And if that happens, maybe, someday, the state of Florida will fall out of the number three ranking in the nation when it comes to human trafficking. After complaints of inhumane treatment in women's correctional facilities throughout Florida, one state lawmaker is calling for a change. We get that story from Blaze Ganey.
In 2015, the Miami Herald wrote about conditions at the Lowell Correctional Institution in Ocala. The report contained comments from inmates who say they've been pressured by guards to have sex to avoid punishment or receive hygiene products. There were also stories about inmates dying under suspicious conditions after making complaints about ill treatment. After hearing similar stories from women at Lowell Correctional Institution and other prisons throughout Florida, Democrat Representative Chevron Jones says he wants changes.
I've heard it from these various women about men guards who would make women do sexual favors in exchange for feminine products or for health products.
Dignity for Incarcerated Women Act, sponsored by the South Florida representative, would make those items free. The bill also requires that health care products be placed in common housing areas. Jones said many of the requirements of the bill are things he thought were already practiced.
One would think that we are ensuring that although an individual may be incarcerated, that he or she, but in this instance, she will still be given the dignity that she deserves while behind bars, outside of whatever crime she committed.
The proposed law also requires that male correctional officers announce their presence when entering a housing unit and also document if they pat down a woman. Florida Police Benevolent Association's Executive Director Matt Puckett says that's already being done.
That's standard. If you do a pat down, you're going to do an incident report on that and document it. And my guess is most of the, I'd say the large majority of officers would prefer to have female officers do the pat-downs on females.
The legislation says the only reason a male correctional officer should conduct a pat-down or body cavity search on a woman is when there's an immediate risk and a female guard is not available. But Puckett believes that may be difficult due to staff shortages and scheduling conflicts.
The problem that you're going to have with, you know, most agencies, but particularly with the Department of Corrections, is the staffing and the shortages. So there just may not be feasible with who is working the shift.
If Jones's measure is approved, restrooms, showers, and other areas where incarcerated women may be undressed will be off limits to male officers unless there is a medical emergency or an immediate risk of harm to an inmate or staff. Representative Jones says it's still early in the bill process, and like most legislation, he expects the proposal to be changed by the time it reaches the floor.
There are some parts in there that may stay in there and some things that may come out. And some things may be defined just a little bit more.
The bill is being sent to three committees. Its first stop is the Criminal Justice Subcommittee. A hearing date has not been announced. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Blaze Ganey.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, we began the program with a new governor coming into office. We close out the show with Florida's senior United States Senator leaving office. Senator Bill Nelson's nearly three-decade-long political career has come to an end. After a contentious election and chaotic recount, Governor Rick Scott will take over as Florida's senator this month. WMFE's space reporter Brendan Byrne looks back at Nelson's time on Capitol Hill and the lasting impact on the space industry.
On one of his last days in office, Senator Bill Nelson saw the Senate pass the Space Frontier Act. If passed by the House, it would extend the life of the International Space Station and roll back regulations to help develop commercial space partnerships.
This bill is another step building on the NASA Authorization Act that we passed a year ago. And so, indeed, it is my privilege to be out here and to be a part of the passage of this legislation.
It's fitting one of Nelson's last feats as a lawmaker was moving a space bill through the Senate. For the better part of 30 years, the 76-year-old native Floridian championed space policy.
Senator Nelson has been a strong advocate for space, and particularly Kennedy Space Center and Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, especially with regards to the more traditional big NASA programs.
That's space policy analyst Laura Forsick.
Most recently, the Space Launch System. He was a big champion of that program and continues to be, even in his final farewell speech.
Nelson's passion for space took off back in 1986 when NASA selected two politicians to send on the space shuttle. On a cool January morning, Nelson and six other crewmates blasted off from Kennedy Space Center on a six-day mission.
3, 2, 1. We have ignition. We have liftoff. Liftoff of Columbia on mission 61C, and the shuttle has cleared the tower.
During his final floor speech earlier this month, Nelson credited that trip to space as a moment of clarity and an event that changed the way he approached legislating.
And of course, I strapped in to launch to the heavens and to see our planet from a way that very few others have. You've heard me talk about that as I describe our environment and how beautiful this planet is from the window of a spacecraft.
Former Obama administration senior advisor Phil Larson says Nelson's ability to reach across the aisle and move space policy forward was one of his strong suits, and he worked for the benefit of Floridians and the Kennedy Space Center.
Senator Nelson stood behind President Obama when he signed the NASA Authorization Act of 2010, and Senator Nelson was in the room again in the Oval Office with the Trump administration when they put forward their space legislation and signed it into law.
With Nelson out, the future of space policy, especially from Florida legislators, is uncertain. Analyst Laura Forsick says it's unlikely the state's soon-to-be senior senator, Marco Rubio, will be the same advocate for space.
But it hasn't been a strong interest. He hasn't been a champion that Senator Nelson has been.
Late in his career, Nelson was criticized for not fighting hard enough to keep the space shuttle program alive. NASA decided to end the program in 2011, citing budgetary and safety concerns. But ending the shuttle program put thousands of Floridians out of work.
And it's a tricky situation where he had to both balance the interests of his constituents in Florida as well as the interest of NASA as a whole and the nation as a whole.
The senator also faced backlash for using his political clout to score himself a seat on that 1986 shuttle mission, a seat some critics argue would be better served by a scientist, not a politician. Despite the criticism, Nelson will be remembered as the senator who went to space and the lawmaker who prioritized space policy. But the Space Frontier Act, that last piece of legislation, ultimately died in the House. With that bill, a nearly 30-year political career came to a wheels stop.
Houston, Columbia, we got wheels stop.
Welcome back to Earth, you seasoned space veterans.
I'm Brandon Byrne in Orlando.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.